Now, one more thing I'm going to say about these before we go on that I didn't say because I glossed over the slide that had to do with the RNA mobile genetic elements versus the DNA, which are called transposases versus the transposons. I didn't want to get a lot of jargon. The way in which scientists today do genetic engineering is they use these guys to do it because they're so accurate. Now, they've gone on to do zinc fingers, but they are they're found in prokaryotes, and they are engineered to do this. So, I mean, CRISPR. If you are looking at how accurate these are, and if you want to put genes in a certain area, you can go to China, and there is you can buy the proper mobile genetic element that will take whatever gene or whatever you want to take in, or if you want to take in a knockout blow to a gene, you can buy it from them, and you can introduce it for mice, cats. They don't have it for humans, or if they do, they're not selling it yet. My guess is they do. I don't know. I'm just wondering. But anyway, that's how accurate these things are. They are very. It's not like shooting buckshot at the wall and hoping some of it hits some good targets. These are targeted. You know, what a cruise missile is the best illustration I have for it. Okay, what do these TEs do to transposable elements do to a genome? The question is, and we're going to be broaching here, is maybe God made these. And I'm going to tell you right now, what did Christ say? A house divided against itself cannot stand. Why would he put material into the cell that it takes the cell 30% of its energy every day to fight off? And I'm going to show you what the transposable elements do, which are the very things Christ healed when he came down here. So why would he introduce a system when at the end of the first day of the first week of creation, he said all is very good? Why would he then amend it later and put in this stuff, and I'm going to show you what it does. Rather than get into a detailed discussion of how mobile genetic elements differ from normal DNA, we could go on for a very long time on that. There is charge migration down DNA. Your DNA carries an electric charge, and when it comes to the mobile genetic elements, the charge slows down. It doesn't go as fast. No one knows why. There's physical as well as code reasons why I am arguing that they have two different authors. It causes aging. I'm going to show you a slide on this. Death. I'm talking the first death. We don't have time to talk about salvation tonight, but there I'm going to give you a little fun homework. Go home and look up the Landauer equation. It's the amount of heat that's released with every bit of energy that's destroyed, and then you can figure it out. Cancer, definitely. There is no cancer that I have found or that anyone has, that I've been able to go through on Google Scholar and other forums that have not found mobile genetic elements to be the etiological agent at the very beginning, or at least is so closely associated, you don't know if it's the etiological agent or if environment. But I'd argue that the environment wouldn't have the way to make it mutagenic if it weren't that if you didn't have the mobile genetic element there in the first place. All genetic, that should be a no-brainer. Autoimmune diseases, there's a sense and an antisense part of the DNA. When it opens up, the side that's being read and the protein coding area, we'll call that the sense. Well, actually, the antisense side, and I didn't go into pseudogenes, and I'm just going to touch on it very briefly. Don't let this clog your brain. About 1.2 to 1.5% of the human genome is bona fide protein coding areas that we're going to say that there are so much intact that we're going to say we're part of the original equipment. I can't say that. I wasn't there, but let's just for ease of discussion say it's original equipment. About 8% of the genome is the pseudogenes, and the pseudogenes are two types. One type is that there was genes they think they were originally in the original formula that have been so rearranged by mobile genetic elements now that it's hard to distinguish exactly what they were to do in the first place, but they now code for proteins that do different things, and we're going to talk about some of the things they do, and the reason I'm bringing this up now is they do some things in the body that are vital for the body. We're going to get to that in a moment. The other side of the, I lost my train of thought. I was just telling you about Pseudogenes, yes. I was just talking, I told you about the other part are actually genes that are brought in from the outside, and oftentimes they're brought in with viruses, and you can tell it's virus because you can see the virus code right after the protein coding area. And the FOS family, which is so important for addiction, remember that we get Delta FOS B from, is one of those. It's the marine sarcoma virus. If you go to mice, you can get the exact code sequence from the mice. It causes sarcoma. What it is in your genome and it is mine. The difference is it has a tail in ours, which allows that, it's like a promoter, which allows that protein coding area to be triggered by a number of stress things in our life. All right, it's a promoter. That promoter is not there when you go into the marine sarcoma virus, but we have that, and it's in every one of our genomes, which allows us to become addicted. We went through that last time in the VTA. The autoimmune disease, the antisense side of some of these mobile, of these pseudogenes, code for, ends up coding for protein. I should tell you that they have done two papers, one in 2003 and one in 2011, called the ENCODE Project, which tells you that well over 80%, they suggest maybe over 90% of the genome is transcribed. It's not junk. It's not silent. It's not non-usable DNA. It is making. Some of the proteins that it makes are destroyed and don't go anywhere, but a lot of the proteins do. And rheumatoid arthritis and a number of others, there are papers linking it to the antisense part of the pseudogene that comes in that's being transcribed. That's probably too deep. Forget it. I'm just telling you that this isn't junk. It's transcribed. Endocrine and metabolic diseases, we're going to look at psychiatric diseases, and we're actually going to say, well, so what about the diseases? What is it that makes us selfish? This is January 2018. This is a new book. I just took one of the first pages that gives you a table of contents just to kind of look at the things that they're talking about, and what I included it is, this is now becoming the hot topic on how you can get species change. The impact of transposable elements in the genome, evolution, and genetic instability and their implication in various diseases. It goes through 250 diseases in this paper. I just put this up there to just kind of give you a flavor. We're not going to go through them. To get taken together, the mechanisms discussed above have demonstrated the considerable impact of TEs on human genome evolution, genetic instability, and disease occurrence. Understatement. Two-thirds of the neuron genome that you have that populate your brain are aneuploidy. What's aneuploidy? That means they either have more than 46 chromosomes or they have less than 46 chromosomes, but they don't have exactly 46. You've heard of trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome. Well, you have 46 chromosomes, but you have two full 21 chromosomes, but then you have varying lengths of a third 21 chromosome. If you have just a little bit of it, there's mild retardation, and you have mild, they're considered a mild form of Down syndrome, and if they have, the closer they get to a full 23rd full chromosome, the more they demonstrate the web fingers, the Mongolian eye, the all the other things, and the more chances that they are to be less fit from an intellectual and problem solving area. Okay, so aneuploidy is not good. There's trisomy 18, there's trisomy 13. Most of the trisomies or the die in, and there are spontaneous abortions. But there's a few that get through, but they usually don't live long. Trisomy 21 is one example that can live longer, depending upon how much of that 21st chromosome you have. So it's not good. So two-thirds... the existence of aneuploid cells within the mammalian brain has suggested the influence of genetic mosaicism on normal neural circuitry. And what they said was, when scientists first looked at this and they first saw it in mice and everything, well, humans have the same issue, is that they said, well, they must not work. So you must be working on one-third because these that are aneuploidic obviously are not to be, don't work. Well, this paper, which was presented in 2005, says no, they're functionally active. They're in the mix. And it says, coincident labeling for immediate early gene expression indicate that these aneuploid neurons were functionally active. These results demonstrate that functioning neurons with aneuploid genomes form genetically mosaic neural circuitries as part of the normal organization of the mammalian brain. Well, let's see. Let's see if this is good or bad. We need to go on. I probably have 25 very germane papers that deal with this, at least 10, and I'm not going to spare you with them. I'm going to let this gentleman, Gerald Crabtree, who printed this in 2013, and I printed it in Trends in Genetics, he made a comment, and he said, actually, I thought this was important enough, I brought the paper, and I want to read you a paragraph here. Forgive me, I put a little bit here, but I think we need to read a little more. It says, I'll start here because I'm going to read past that. I would wager that if an average citizen of Athens of 100 BC were to appear suddenly among us, he or she would be among the brightest and most intellectually alive of our colleagues and companions, with a good memory, a broad range of ideas, and a clear-sighted view of important issues. Furthermore, I would guess that he or she would be among the most emotionally stable of our friends and colleagues. I would also make this wager for the ancient inhabitants of Africa, Asia, India, or the Americans of perhaps 2,000 to 6,000 years ago. The basis for my wager comes from new developments in genetics, anthropology, neurobiology that make a clear prediction that our intellectual and emotional abilities are genetically surprisingly fragile. And then he goes on to say, to assess this fragility, we must first know how many genes are required for our intellectual abilities. The larger the number of genes required, the more susceptible we are as a species. And he ends up coming up with 2,000 to 5,000 genes that are involved in this. And then he brings up the aneuploidy issue. And the fact that every one of the neurons you have, the genomes from one to the other is not the same. They're all different. That's when the word mosaic means that you have a whole, like you do a mosaic picture, you have many different colors and you bits and pieces that you put in. They're all different. Now, that's not all bad, because how do we get memories? We take stem cells in the brain that then go down and become the anchor cells in what we call a circuit that help you remember something. And that genome is owned by, that genome of that anchor cell for that thought, that's one of its main purpose. But the funny part is it can be a part of many other brain circuits. And, but it's the anchor cell for this idea. And so if you are able to take the stem cells that are going to be making your memory and you make them faulty, you get memory issues. And I'm not going to get into Alzheimer's disease, but Alzheimer's disease now, and I've got a definitive article, says that it comes from breaking of DNA, and specifically DNA that is in the area of high repeat colonies, which are these mobile genetic elements. They're also called repetitive elements. So the repetitive elements make your DNA less stable. They also make the DNA double helix more stiff and more likely to break. And the more breaks you have, the more these other mobile genetic elements that are sitting around can jump in, and endonuclease can sew them in, and now they're part of you. And if it gets into your stem cells, and I should back up, these mobile genetic elements have preference for two types of cells, those that are going to be part of the CNS and those that are going to make up the gametes, whether it's the ovum or the sperm. If you put them into cell dishes and they've done that, you will find they have a predilection to go to those two types of stem cells that are coming from those two areas. So it's not shooting buckshot. The evidence that it's not shooting buckshot is really overwhelming. And it's very clear. So if you can get it into the stem cells, you've got it into that species, because that's what's going to be passed on to the progeny. Okay, shared molecular neuropathology across major psychiatric disorders parallels polygenetic overlap. February of 2018, and it's from Science. So I thought maybe I better get some stuff in that's really new. If you look, this is a busy slide. We're not going to spend a lot of time. I just want you to look at this. Environment is on the side. Remember, environment can trump a lot of the things that you're going to be given, the hand that's going to be dealt you as far as to the four letters that are put into your genome. And so it influences everywhere along here, and it does it through pathways that we call epigenetics. That's methylation or acetylation or deacetylation. That's a lot of big words. It's whether you cover up the DNA with histones, which is a protein blanket, and keep them from being transcribed, or whether you open up that protein blanket and allow them to be transcribed. That's a very oversimplification, but for our discussion today, it's probably deep enough, okay? So that's what the environment brings in. But what you have is common genetic variations. I'm going to tell you right now, this article puts about 200 genes that are the usual suspect when you come to psychiatric illnesses. And what they have done is they have showed you the overlap of mood that they come into, and this is what they translate into: autism, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, and alcohol abuse. And this is, if on this axis, which you can't see, would be the number of gene clusters that are involved, and that these 200 genes, protein coding areas, oftentimes you will have to have two areas that are heavily involved in mobile genetic elements and therefore have at least a single nucleotide polymorphism, or they have whole repeat areas that come in, or worse, they copy number variation where they flip the gene and they make two or three of these protein coding genes in a row, which is not good. Don't say, oh, that's wonderful. Anytime you get anytime you get more than one copy of genes and you start multiplying them and then you flip their direction, it's usually pathologically associated with some type of phenotype that you get down the line. And I just wanted you to show that they now have come down with about the 200 genes that are involved, and they all come in sort of package problems with major depression, it's reward dysfunction and mood disturbance. Why is alcohol out here? Well, they have dopamine 2 receptors in the nucleus accumbens that are hard to let me back up. When you have a neurotransmitter comes in, it's like a lock and a key, and it goes to the receptor, turns the key, and then the inside, it's in the membrane of the cell and on the inside of that protein, and now changes its conformation, and an active site is now available, and it begins to do work in the cell to make new molecules or change molecules that are there, okay? If this receptor has a number of amino acids that are off for whatever reason, its conformation changes, and like with a lock and a key, if you change the conformation, it's like when your key wears out and doesn't work in your lock anymore, the tumblers don't fall. This is a very broad generalization, but it's sort of the concept. So what happens when the dopamine comes into these people, it doesn't turn the key, the tumblers don't fall. They don't get reward. This is called award deficit syndrome. They don't get reward. And so what happens is, the first time they have heroin, the first time they drink alcohol, their system is flooded because both of those cause an excessive amount of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens to be released. The area is flooded like never before with dopamine, and when you get such a high concentration of dopamine, it's able to flip the tumblers. And they'll tell you for the first time they feel normal. These are the people that with one drink or one shot of heroin are addicted, and it's somewhere between 5 and 10%, depends on who you read. And it's due to their dopamine. Now, I drive by these poor people that are under the underpasses, and I think, well, they shouldn't have been drinking, or, well, they shouldn't have gotten on drugs. And they shouldn't have. No one put a gun to their head to take that sip of alcohol. No one got them going on that first a shot to drugs, but their hill to climb to get out from that first exposure is a much steeper hill than yours and mine. So who are we to judge against them? And why did the Savior gravitate to these? And why did the Savior work so hard and associate himself with him. Why? Because if you're well, you don't need a physician. But we've all got this disease. Enough about mental illness. Gene conflicts, the usual suspects and beyond. 2017, Journal of Experimental Biology. Selfishness is pervasive and manifests at all scales of biology, from societies to individuals to genetic elements within a genome. In this review, we explore insights gleaned from the molecular and genetic studies of such genetic conflicts, both extrinsic between genomes and intrinsic within genomes or cells. We argue that many different characteristics of selfish genetic elements, by the way, that term is often used for transposable elements, mobile genetic elements. They're also called selfish genetic elements because they want to take over your genome for themselves and use it for their own purposes. We argue that many different characteristics of selfish genetic elements can be distilled into two types of advantages: an over-replication advantage, mobile genetic elements and genomes, and a transmission distortion advantage, a mitotic drivers in populations. These two general categories may help classify disparate types of selfish genetic elements. I'm not going to try to translate that for you. We don't need to. I wanted you to see the word selfish, okay, and see what they're talking about. That's the war that's going on in your genome between the, well, let's get real simple here, non-scientific, between the good guys and the bad guys, okay? I don't have time to go through this study and about three or four others that we have, but they could take a buccal smear. They did this in Israel, and I believe it was published in 2006. Anyway, they can take a buccal smear, and they can predict with 80% probability whether you're going to act selfishly in these in the dictator game or in the pro-social fund allocation game, I mean social value orientations task game. And I don't have time to talk about the games. It's fascinating today. Another thing, if you want to go to game theory, look up Prisoner's Dilemma. You will find out that was one of the first games that they did. And what they found out is that this determines on how selfish you are. And I don't want to get into it because I'll get into it afterwards if you want to talk. It's a very interesting dilemma. But across all societies, the vast, vast, vast majority of people will always pick the most selfish option, whether it's in these games or it's in the Prisoner's Dilemma game. And in fact, what game theory is all about is building in self-interest, what's in it for me, and to get people to do what's right. And that's the whole idea of how game theory came about. And there's some really good books on that. I'll tell you about them later if you want to, offline, if you want to get them. Footprint, okay. This is a stunning article, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, May 11, 2010. John Avice, he's just down the road here at UC Irvine, and he wrote a rather devastating article, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, where he talks about the genome and says, you know what, if a God created this genome, shame on him, because what is coded for in this genome is detestable. And I'm here to tell you, he's right. He quotes very reputable journals to make his point. And this is close to the last paragraph, and it says, evolution by natural causes and effect emancipates religion from the shackles of theodicy. No longer need we agonize about why a creator God is the world's leading abortionist. And that's because the mobile genetic elements, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, are very active as the new fetus-embryo is made. It's extremely active, and they cause abortions because they cause aneuploidy coming out early. And you know that over 50% of all the fetuses that are conceived are aborted. You know that. Well over 50%, and the number is going up, and we can discuss why, but I'm going to say it's because of decreased genetic fitness, and that's not my argument. I can show you the papers that say that. No longer need we agonize why a creator God is the world's leading abortionist and mass murderer. No longer need we query a creator God's motives for debilitating countless innocents with horrific genetic conditions. No longer must we anguish about the interventionalist motives of a supreme intelligence that permits gross evil and suffering in the world. His argument is, if you look at the genome and God is the creator of that genome, then you're going to have a virtually impossible ability to defend that genome as coming from a loving creator. He does it in a lot more direct way, and I didn't put it up here. If you're interested, you should read the article. And the points he makes, I believe, are true. I don't know how you would refute them. They're done very well. He's made very good arguments. And then how do we deal with this? And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. If God says that our present genome is very good, then I need to know what his other definitions are. Maybe his definitions for death is not what we think. Maybe his definition for eternal life isn't what we think. Maybe his definition that he's loving isn't what we think. Because what's in the genome, yes, the genome is marvelous, and what a genome does is great, but there's a lot of coded information there for a lot of malicious stuff. So what happened? Biological description. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Now, if you read anything from Dr. Spock on, they will tell you that for punishment to be effective, you have to wait till after the deed occurs. You have to, as soon as possible after the deed occurs, you have to sit the child down. You have to tell them what is wrong, why they shouldn't do it. And then the punishment should be dealt out to be something that accentuates what you say, not, and that brings to the, makes the child really consider what's being discussed. They lost. They became quote unquote naked before God had ever talked to them. So people say, well, this was a punishment. I would argue, no, it's not. Then you'd be arguing that humans are smarter about how to administer punishment than God is. And I think that's an unsustainable argument. Something happened physically. And what is one of the things that we're told in Revelation 3, that this robe of light, which is not, it's just something's inferred here that changed, they went naked. It doesn't say it was a robe of light, but one of the first things that's given to the those that ever come is a robe of light. And I was just listening to Great Controversy, the last chapter, and she talks about that robe as being a direct result of a character that resembles Christ's. And we've actually gone looking into the genetic literature, and there's some stuff that's sort of suggestive, but anyway, every time you have meiosis in your cell, mitosis, you release a photon. So there is something in your body that does release photons, but I think it probably has something to do with God's glory, that there is then some type of a reflow back. I don't know. Don't want to get lost there. That's all conjecture. Don't quote me. I'm just thinking out loud. But you'd have to have the right proteins and cellular capabilities to take the, if that is it, to take God's glory and have this formed into something like that. So I'm going to argue, or I'm going to suggest to you, not argue, I'm going to suggest to you that this was a physical change, because when you look down and now you don't have a robe of light and you did before, that's a physical change. There was one other physical change. There was a physical change in the mental attitude. I'm going to Ellen White now. Why did Adam eat of the fruit? When Eve went bringing it to him, his face fell, according to Ellen White, Patriarchs and Prophets, and he knew that she had eaten of the fruit, that they had been prohibited, and he knew now that she must die. So what did he do? He debated in himself. He goes, I shouldn't have let her get out of my sight. And he says, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I can't live without you. I'm going to grab the fruit, and he ate it. When God comes down, he calls for them, and they come running out, and he says, why are you afraid? And they said, well, we're naked. And he goes, did you eat of the fruit I told you not to eat of? And what did Adam say? Well, that woman that you gave me, I tell you, if you hadn't created her, we wouldn't have these problems. I mean, you know. And so God looks at the woman and she goes, well, you made the snake. The snake is the one. There's a change now in the way their central processing unit, which is their brain, is working. And this is before God's dealt out anything. All right? So I'm going to argue that something physical has already happened to them. I wasn't there, can't prove it, but I'm just taking circumstantial evidence and I'm trying to follow down the line. This was not a punishment. God responds, and I will put enmity between thee and the woman and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now we know that God's talking to the snake here, and you know the serpent now is always in the Bible. It represents who? Satan. All right, and so I'm going to ask you, the word seed, we're going to get to in a moment, is zera. There's six different Hebrew words that can mean progeny or a genetic line. And I'll show you in a moment the word zera actually means, remember Onan's curse? His brother died without his wife having any children. So the Hebrew way was then she had to marry the next son, and Onan was the next brother. And before he ejaculated, he pulled out and he spilled his zera onto the ground. So that's how the, now there are three places in the Old Testament where zera does refer to something more like progeny, but the times where it does refer here, I believe, would sustain the position that that's what this is talking about when seed. Okay, what seed does the devil have? Notice he doesn't talk to Adam. Why didn't he say to Adam and Eve, between your seed and his seed? Why does he only pick the woman? Or is that just because she pointed to the snake and so God points to her next and says, well, I'm going to talk to you then? I mean, that's possible. But why does he limit it to the woman? And this is the way we've been explaining it. This is a different translation, contemporary English version. You and this woman will hate each other, your descendants and hers will always be enemies. One of hers will strike you on the head and you will strike him on the heel. That's the way we've read this. I'm going to suggest that we read it literally and look at it a little differently. This is zera. This in Greek, the Greek word for any of the Hebrew of these 1, 2, 3, 4, six Hebrew words is always sperma, which we get spermatozoa from. When we talk about, whenever you see seed in the New Testament, you go look it up, it's sperma or some variant of sperma. And zera is seed, sowing, or semen, virile. And I told you where to look it up. You can look it up in Genesis and the story of Onan if you want to collaborate it. Small RNAs as guardians of the genome. This is marvelous. When we read about this 4 years ago, I just could not believe it. Transposons populate the landscape of all eukaryotic genomes. Once considered purely genomic parasites, notice the word, transposons can also benefit their hosts, playing roles in gene regulation and in genome organization and evolution. Peaceful coexistence with mobile elements, that's mobile genetic elements, depends upon adaptive control mechanisms, since unchecked transposon activity can impact long-term fitness and acutely reduce the fertility of progeny. Here we review the conserved roles played by small RNAs in the adaptation of eukaryotes to coexist with their genomic colonists. See, there's no question in the person who's writing this paper that mobile genetic elements are interlopers. They're not part of the original equipment, or you wouldn't be writing it this way. And Colin is a male, so I can say that. An understanding of transposon defense pathways. Notice that, transposon defense pathways in the cell. If God had put this originally in the cell, why would we now have to have defense pathways against it? Then really, is he the loving God he's portrayed himself out to be if he is the author of these? That's a legitimate question. Has uncovered recurring themes in the mechanisms by which genomes distinguish self from non-self. and selectively silence the latter. Early clues to the nature of the maternal factor came from observations that PIWI proteins are essential for transposon silencing in the contents of several models of hybrid dysgenesis. Moreover, both PIWI and, that's the abiogenetic, are proteins, don't worry about that, are maternally deposited and accumulate in the pole plasm, the specialized cytoplasm at the posterior end of the developing embryo that will give rise to the future germline. Let me translate. The mother, because the egg is a rather large cell and the sperm is a protein coat, a flagellum, and a genome, the mother carries within her two enzymes, and the next slide is going to show it, so spoiler alert. And these two enzymes only work at one period of time during the new zygote development before the embryo. We're back at the very, in fact, it's in the first couple of weeks. It's when it's at the blastocele stage, when there are eight cells. As it divides from 1 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8, something happens. The epigenetic marks, and just remember I said methylation, come off of the genome. Now, those marks are very important. They're inherited, by the way, up to the second and third generation, and then they go away. It's called parental imprinting, and you get it from the parents, and we didn't even go into that. They go away by the fourth generation, and there's a lot of elegant studies that show this. These marks keep certain parts of the genome from being transcribed, or at least greatly limit the amount of transcription that occurs in those areas. And what happens is, during the first early dividing, these marks fall away, but then something happens when you get to eight cells. All 46 chromosomes, I'm going to use, when I say line up in the nucleus, it's, you know, they're in a jumbled mass. But for our discussion, let me simplify it and say that they all line up. Maternal here, paternal there. They are now open, wide open, all open from A to Z. Everything can be worked on. And I will tell you, at this point, there is massive mobile genetic implantation into that genome because it's not protected by the protein coat called the histones. But let's not go there. What happens is this AUB PIWI protein complex, there's multiple ones of it. They go through the entire genome, and they happen to know how, science can't tell us, where to replace these methylation marks so that that part of the genome is covered up. And they go through all 3.2 billion base pairs. And if they make a mistake, if it's in a major area, the fetus aborts. Because if you leave these, the full load of mobile transposable elements to be transcribed, it's death to that growing baby. So why would God put these in? That's another question. If this is something he put in, why would he have to make then this system? Well, you see where I'm going. I'm just throwing these out for you to think about. It's only found in the mother. It does not come in with dad. So I'm going to suggest to you, when Christ is looking at the serpent, which is the devil, he says, guess what? What you put in is not going to run free. It's not going to get a free hall pass to go whatever it wants. I'm going to put something in Eve, the one you tricked, and it's going to put a harness on what you've put in there. And we're going to come back to putting enmity over and over again in the last part of this lecture. So don't forget that text. This is the first application of enmity, but I'm going to show you more. This is only found in the mother. And that would fit perfectly with that statement where he says, I will put enmity between, and this is my translation, Bob Miloshenko translation, between the DNA that I put in this woman and the rewrite that you're bringing in. You are not going to get free run. And let me tell you something, in case you're thinking that you've outsmarted me in this system that you've put in, let me tell you how things are going to end very badly for you. Yes, I'm going to pay a price, but it's going to end very badly for you. Just so you know. Small RNAs present in maternal germ cells are also faithfully transmitted to progeny. Since the sperm discards most of its cytoplasm post-mitotically, similar species are likely not paternally inherited. This gives rise to a clear difference in embryonic content of the inhibitory RNAs, that's what the PI stands for, depending upon whether an element was maternally or paternally inherited, and these differences correlated perfectly with the ability of progeny to silence. This genesis is bad. This means that you're doing bad, so bad genetics, bad genetic inducing transposon. These studies demonstrate that differences in inheritance of maternal small RNA populations underlie hybrid dysgenesis. Again, dysgenesis is a bad word. That's all you have to look at and realize it's not doing good for the genome. They also highlighted the broader conclusion that maternally inherited small RNAs are required to prime resistance pathways at each generation in order to effectively silence at least some of those elements. And this presence of sequences within the piRNA cluster corresponding to a particular element may not alone be sufficient to achieve effective silencing in the absence of maternal small RNAs. So this isn't the only, this is the basic of the systems, but there's more things that now depend upon this methylation that then come in and finish off the silencing. Now let's go to what happened in the rest of the story. Then God says, I'm going to curse. And what he says we're going to go to the snake in a moment. You know what? I really got upset by what you did. And I'm going to make it now so that you have to crawl on the ground and you're going to eat dust and you're going to be abhorred by everybody. That's my punishment for you. And then what he said to the woman was, he says, look it, you're going to wish you'd never done that, eaten that apple. Because when you have children, with every contraction, you're going to wish you hadn't done it. And boy, will you wish. And oh yeah, you don't know what pain is? Well, let me tell you, pain is really not good. And there's an argument in science as to which is the worst pain, renal stone, Bob Torrey, or
childbirth.
And quite frankly, I don't know. My opinion is when I go and get a rectal exam, from Bob Torrey, I think that should be added in the mix. But I may have some women who will contend with me on that one, and I'm open for discussion. All right, let me take you to the. I know that. And he puts on these big thick gloves. We'll stop there. We don't need to go further. Hebrew, the word arar means to bind. Hem in with obstacles, render powerless to resist. And I'm not going to go through all the Hebrew and let you, you can get Esword and you can go through and see for yourself. But powerless to resist is used that way in a number of occasions. And I'm going to just arbitrarily choose to use that in this instance because I'm going to show you why in a minute. Okay? Right away. The snake is cursed. And the Lord said unto the serpent, because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field, and upon thy belly thou shalt go, and dust thou shalt eat all the days of thy life. Well, that implicates that he's on the dust. It tells you that it implicates he's going to get around differently than he did before, but it doesn't really tell you what's lost. But he's going to be, from now on, slithering on the ground. Remember I told you about Hox genes, and I said, please remember those. We're going to come back and revisit those. Well, if you go throughout the entire living tree of life, whether you want to go on the plant side, whether you want to go on the monocellular side, eukaryote, prokaryote, archaea, or you want to go on the mammalian side, the Hox genes, now there are no really Hox genes in unicellular organisms. So the Hox genes come into play when you have much more complex organisms, multicellular organisms. And for instance, in us, the Hox gene clusters, of which there are 16 or 17, are very complex. And I told you, they have a genetic zip code that it can tell what cell goes where in whatever part of the body for a replacement, you know, which I think is pretty phenomenal. There is one species, actually family, that has the Hox clusters, just like we do, that has been severely invaded. Just one. Squamate stands for animals with scales. And what do snakes have? Scales. Hox genes are central to the specification of structures along the anterior posterior body axis, and modifications in their expressions have paralyzed the emergence of diversity in vertebrate body plans. Here we describe the genomic organization of Hox clusters in different reptiles and show that squamates have accumulated unusually large number of transposable elements at these loci, reflecting extensive genomic rearrangements of coding and non-coding regulatory regions. And what has this happened? Well, if you look here, you will see that these boxes represent Hox genes clusters, and they do it on, we're taking schematics, the number there tells you on what chromosome there you will find them. And if you look at, for instance, human, there's really no effect because we're looking for brown, for red or blue in this schematic drawing. Xenopus, those are your frogs and salamanders, things of that nature. They have had some affected. But look down here at the snake group. Look how many of their Hox clusters have been really major league invaded by mobile genetic elements. It says down here, transposable elements are indicated with asterisks of different colors, blue for DNA transposons and red for retrotransposons. Remember I told you there was two different times at the beginning, I just kind of glossed over it. It's okay, you don't need to get into that. This is from Nature, March of 2010. Now this is really complicated, but it's fabulously interesting. I'm not going to go the complicated route. But when whether it's a mouse or a snake, the Hox network starts from the head, and just like a CT scan takes cuts, it codes for regions as you go down. Now, what happened here with the snake is that mobile, I'm going to point out that the genes are present to make all of this stuff here, but only the thoracic is expressed. The rest are turned off. These are all thoracic vertebrae that have ribs. You see that? But there are the genes for a pelvis and hind limbs in the snake. And there's some snakes, and I had some pictures, which have small little buds where the back feet should be, and then there's a couple snakes that actually have little sort of legs. So, but I don't want to get lost in a bunch of stuff here. I'm just telling you, and these are the numbers of the Hox areas that are in charge of coding for that select part of the animal that's being the blueprint that's being put out. Now, the axial pattern in snakes and Sicilians evidence for an alternative interpretation of the Hox code. So, in other words, someone came in and did some messed with the Hox code. This is really complicated. I'm not going to get into it. We call it T-box 5 right here, and then there's Hox B9. And in a normal chicken, you have a wing bud. Guess what? The protein coding areas that make the wing bud are here, but they're not expressed. So at some point in the distant past, snakes had wing buds. Now we can assume they had wings, we don't know for certain, but they had the wing buds that a chicken has, but it's not expressed because T-box 5 has to stop here, and the stop signal, mobile genetic elements have taken it out, and it continues on. When Hox B9 comes in, which develops the heart, because we're working down, see, you'd have, if you had wings, it would, if we're trying to make analogous here, and then you get to the heart. In order for these Hox genes to work, the one Hox area has to turn off, and it sends a signal to the next Hox gene area to turn on, and it's done sequentially. This one does not turn off. This one is turned to turn on, and now in the snake, both are running concurrently. And so what ends up happening is you have a three-chamber heart instead of a four-chamber heart. That's why snakes have three chambers. Now, I'm now going to tell you something which is my guess. I wasn't there. I can't prove it. This is pure hypothesis. But I'm going to guess that God put enmity between the snake's genome and what the devil had put in the snake. Remember the story? The snake, Ellen White says, a snake flew into the tree and what? Started munching on the fruit. And Eve went, whoa, that's one dead snake. And when it didn't die, she goes, I got to go over and see what's happening. I would argue for its body size. And you already, spoiler alert, already, I've spoiled my own punchline, that I think that this type of equipment, at least in its rudimentary form, was in the fruit of the knowledge of tree of good and evil. If you have the tree of life, which you have to eat of to live, it's got biologically active substances, and I would argue that they would have to have some genetic function also. Because in Revelation 22:2, it says the leaves are for the healing of the nations, and Ellen White says people are going to grow up, and the only way you're going to grow up is if you change the genome. There is no other way to do it. I guess God could snap his finger, but we already are told that they're going to do it by eating the leaves. So we've already established that fruit can carry some pretty powerfully genetically active ingredients. And now wouldn't it make sense for God to have the devil with his program on one tree and God's program on the other? We've always told the story that God was like a parent's putting out two bowls of fruit out on the island there of your kitchen and telling the kids you can't eat of the bowl on the right or there's serious consequences, and you understand that they're very serious, but you can eat of the fruit of in the bowl of the right. I just want to see if you obey me. I'm the head of this household, and I have rules, and we've got to establish these rules, and you have to acknowledge that I'm in charge here, and the way we're doing it is you only eat of this fruit, and you don't eat of this fruit. And then one day he comes home, and the six-year-old calls him in. There's some fruit missing from the left bowl, and he says, calls him in and says to the kids, okay, there's some fruit missing here. Who did it? And there's silence. And then finally the six-year-old goes, well, Daddy, I was hungry. I didn't think it was that big of a difference. We were out of oranges and they were here. And the father takes the gun out and shoots the child. Do you think the other two are going to go, oh, well, we love you now. We know that your rules are really, you mean it. We've got the message. Are those children going to love that father? Or are they going to run away to child services and beg for help? That's the way we've told this story. But if God is going to give free will to humans, you have to have something to exercise it on. If you don't have anything to make a choice on, what good is it? In the Soviet Union, they used to say they had free democracy, that they had elections, and what they would do is they would put out a ballot, and it would have the company name of who they wanted, and then they had a place for you to write in. And if you wrote in, the commissar of the area looked up the spelling, looked up your handwriting, figured out who you were, and sent you to the archipelago. And you died there. Is that democracy? Is God being democratic then if he arbitrarily says you can eat of this fruit but not of that fruit? How is that different from the story I just told you? Granted, the circumstances are different, but I want you to look at the logical sequence. But if he is giving them a choice between two different kingdoms, what does Christ say in Luke? I think it's 17:21. The kingdom of God is not outside, it's within you. So I'm going to extrapolate. My kingdom is what I code in you. And if you read, I'm doing a little of salvation. If you read Jeremiah 31, you read Ezekiel 36, or you read Hebrews 8, it says, I will write my laws in your heart. I will write them inside of you. That's the second covenant. That's what changes it from the first. So if we were talking about salvation today, we'd be going into that in a lot more depth. And if you think there's a lot of genetic support for this, at least there's genetic capabilities of doing what the Bible says. Whether that's what God works, I don't know. But everything the Bible says that needs to happen, we now have enough evidence in science on how it could happen. I don't know. Maybe it's not what the way he works. Maybe he works another way. But we're just trying to put together what we can. So this suggests, doesn't prove, that when Ellen White says the snake flew into the tree, she probably saw it. Because cis regulatory modules may be carried around by transposing mobile elements, and because the transposition of mobile elements is the most rapid type of large-scale genomic sequence change in animal genomes, this is likely to be a major mechanism. And what this is talking about is the large, huge genetic control of different systems in evolution. So, if the evolutionists are now have a way, the single nucleotide polymorphism isn't going to work because there's too many there's too much evidence that it can't change phenotype that much, and it completely gets washed out of the system before it can make the big changes that are needed. But boy, if you can bring in whole areas of protein coding, if you can bring in entirely new protein coding areas and then put them into the genome, now you really can do some stuff. And by the way, Ellen White said that God did not create all the species that are on the world now and all the confusion that they're in. I just read an article in one of the major journals that says they estimate there's 33 million species right now. And that doesn't touch the number of species that have lived in the past, of which they say the vast preponderance is now extinct.
So you're talking about dinosaurs?
I'm not talking about dinosaurs. I could talk about that later. All right. And it's clear that there have been great bursts of mobile element insertion in the evolutionary history of many animal lineages, including our own. And the T-box gene, the TBX5 gene, deeply embedded in the vertebrate heart formation network, turns out to be regulated differently during heart formation in reptiles than it is in birds and mammals. And that's why they say from dinosaurs, which are reptilian, that we get birds. Because the evolutionists say, well, you know, the precursors were there for wings.
But it's really the other way around.
That's my view, but I'm trying... Yes, I was hoping you would come to that conclusion. I don't want to force my bias on any of you. Okay. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. Notice he says both, and I don't want to go into Hebrew words, but the sorrow means the trouble you're going to have and your conception. And people have said, well, it's trouble and conception. That's true, but it's not just limited to that. We're going to take it literal. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. No, and you're going to, in grief, it's going to be hard. And thy desire shall be for thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. Dr. Michael Webster, my cohort in crime, forced me to take this part out. But I feel moved to put it in, and I'm going to tell you verbally real quickly. And I will ask you to do your own homework. And it says, and thy desire shall be unto thy husband. Well, people have had a hard time trying to figure out exactly what does that mean. And it can mean, you know, if you one end of the spectrum, let's not go there. You can make a lot of stuff out of what that means. I'm going to tell you, if you look at the Hebrew and you look at it literally, here's a suggestion. And I didn't come up with this idea. A woman wrote it 2 years ago in a symposium dealing with the fall, and it was not literal like this clearly, but. And she made the argument, and I read it carefully and looked it up, and I think she's spot on, that what this means, if you look at the Hebrew, is that remember when God said that the man and the woman would cleave to each other and they would become one flesh? And when I was here last time, I talked about that briefly, and there's a chemical and genetic you really do become one flesh. That's not just an allegory, and it's not that the word cleave, which is really the closest we have to addicted, is true. So what God originally created for the marriage was that when a man and woman consummated the marriage, there would actually be an addiction process, and there we have the mountain and Prairie Voles is a really good example with mobile genetic ailments, and I won't go into it. But that there would have been a man and a woman would have, in essence, mated for life. And if we have in our present world, what if we had in our present world that everyone was far more beautiful than the most handsome or beautiful Hollywood actor or actress? And what if we were all smart and witty, and we were dressed to the nines, and we were very, very charismatic, charming? How much infidelity do you think we would have, given that we have none of that now, and 50% of marriages have it? What do you think? Do you think the number would go down, or do you think the number would go up? Now, if God originally made this marriage to last forever, and he stated that, he has to enable that which he has said is to occur. And I would suggest to you that not only was there, and it is, it's through oxytocin and vasopressin in the male, and it's in the nucleus accumbens, and we can diagram it out for you, that males and females would become addicted, and that way you could never have any children in a broken home, because the children couldn't come until they had started the addiction process. And it would continue going throughout eternity, so it wouldn't get weaker, get stronger. There's something called the Coolidge effect. Go Google it. What it briefly says is that in our present world, in mammals, in mice, humans, goats, they looked at it first in goats, that you will find that there is a predilection for the males to want to mate with as many females as they can. It's called the Coolidge effect. I don't want to go into all the details right now. And that women have the Coolidge effect, but about 10% of what the males do. So this woman on the Hebrew alone came and said, women are still going to be part of this cleavage process, but the male won't be. That men are going to be a problem. The paper, if you ask me for it, in fact, Brent, you sent it to me, I think. Anyway, we can find it for you from the Hebrew point of view, but I can tell you from a physiological point of view, I can give you a lot of circumstantial evidence that that's what we're talking about, but I wasn't there. I can't prove it. We're extrapolating backwards. We're doing historical science, which is fraught with difficulties. And this is the way we normally translate it. I will increase your trouble in pregnancy and your pain in giving birth. In spite of this, you will still have desire for your husband, yet you will be subjugated to him. That's sort of what I said. This is a modern translation, but it's now put into modern words using Hebrew. Transposon-mediated rewiring of gene regulatory networks contribute to the evolution in mammals. I had about 8 papers that go over this. No, 5. Anyway, what this paper said is that mobile genetic ailments brought in pseudogenes which allowed the endometrial cells to be responsible to progesterone, without which you could not have a period. You wouldn't have a menstrual cycle. You would not have periods. This was wired in extra. And I'm not going to read this all the way through. You can read it and get a good idea real quick, those of you that have a scientific bent. I'm tired of reading slides. And it's a MIR 20, and this MIR 20 is going to do a number of things with pregnancy. And placental mammals, guess what? The evolution of the placenta and viviparity, that means being born alive, is related to LTR retrotransposon-derived genes in mammals. It turns out that a number of pseudogenes have been brought in, a large number, that is a gene regulatory network, and I referred to those earlier, that have brought in the placenta, the entire architectural protein-coated areas needed for a placenta were brought in. They weren't there originally. And we can give you a lot of, I can give you a lot if you're interested. We can send you a lot of papers on this. I'm just going to say it makes the placenta. I don't want to get into this. Here's the big key, and this one I am going to read, the one in red. The human placenta, unique in its active expression of retroviral sequences that are not expressed in other tissues, so it's only expressed in the placenta, may hold the key to an improved understanding of the functional significance of HERVs. Human endogenous retroviruses are one of the types of viruses. Remember, there's two main types of mobile genetic elements. One is viruses, and the other is the transposon-transposase group. One is brought in by coats. It can be brought in now. It's you. It can edit you now. I mean, look at the Zika virus. Look what it does to the sutures of new babies developing. Look at the AIDS virus. Look at the Ebola virus. If you think that, I've heard people sneer at me and go, "You're saying that sin is like a viral cold?" No. If you say that, you are ignorant about viruses. They can change any and everything about you. They kill you. What about meningitis that completely wreaks havoc with your brain? Is that like a cold? They take in genetic, they bring in genetic material, the same type of material that determines what you are, and they rewrite things. You think that that's just a simple cold? It's like taking someone with a pop gun and comparing it to a nuclear bomb. On one side, there's a weapon, you call it a pop gun. On the other side, there's a nuclear bomb. We're talking nuclear bombs here, and to look at the pop gun and say, well, how could that be? You're ignoring all the evidence of the lethality of this same group. You're picking the most innocent of the group and making your judgment on that. You're excluding the majority of evidence that has to do with mobile genetic elements. Anyway, it says may be a key to an improved understanding of the functional significance of HERVs. In this review, we discover the contribution of retro elements, particularly HERVs, to placental function and dysfunction. What this paper went on to say is that the placenta puts out voluminous amounts of mobile genetic elements of all types, and some types that aren't expressed anywhere else in the body at any other time. It's only in a woman who is pregnant, that bathe that baby in the amniotic fluid, which guarantees that no baby can be born without complete inoculation, as if we could get rid of two-thirds of our genome. We can't. There's capsid systems and all kinds of systems that shut down the cells called apoptosis and get rid of it. But suppose people have said to me, well, you've made sin to be such a simple thing. That means we can genetically alter it. No, you can't. Because they've tried to take out small things in humans. They've tried to work on certain issues like Huntington's chorea and everything. You know what? Just putting in small amounts of genetic material by excision causes all kinds of problems. Because the genome has at least 12 different codes within a code, within a code, within a code. So when you take one nucleotide and change it, you are changing 12 codes that are coding for different informational aspects of what's going to be developed and made. It's like taking a chess game and having it 12 boards high, and any move you make on this board has to be made on all the other boards, and you have 12 people competing against you that can come in with a different plan. And then when you have the complexity of the different gene regulatory networks and all of things that are combined, because most protein coding areas are not just defined by one regulatory network, they're in multiple regulatory networks. So therefore, to try to make that move would be impossible, and I'm going to argue that the devil thought it was impossible. This is an ingenious system. He's got a target that's constantly moving. And by the way, these things mutate at a much higher rate. Why? Because they're made sloppily. The TR, the reverse transcriptase, is a very lumbersome, large molecule that really does a poor job, and it works about half or a third the speed that DNA polymerase works at. And DNA polymerase makes about one mistake out of every million. RT makes a lot of mistakes that, you know, much less than that. So it's a very, very inferior machine. Anyway, this assures that just in case someone came up with a way to genetically engineer these out, which you can't, 66% of the genome conservatively, probably closer to 80%, we couldn't do it. We wouldn't be us. And I'm sure the devil is thinking, how can God do that? How can he remove this stuff and keep you, you, and me, me? And that's what we get to under the salvation issue, which we're not going to get to tonight. So that's a little, that's bait and switch, isn't it? I'm not above it. Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Now, to me, that makes sense. The people who read this before said, see, sin is, sex is sinful. Go read Psalms 51. 5. No, what did God say on the end of the sixth night? Probably when Adam and Eve were consummating their marriage, he goes, it's very good. Now Adam's cursed. And he said unto the man, you listened to your wife and you ate the fruit, which I told you not to eat. Because of what you have done, the ground will be under a curse. You will have to work hard for all your life to make it produce enough food for you. It will produce weeds and thorns, and you will have to eat wild plants. You will have to work hard and sweat to make the soil produce anything. And you will go back to the soil from which you are formed. You are made from soil, and you will become soil again. So this is talking death. Oh, I wanted to say one last thing on pain. Trust me, we're not going into this in any depth. This is a drive-by statement. There's 90% proof that we have a complex that goes through a receiver, a receptor that goes through the membrane 7 times. It's I'm trying to think of the term for it right now. Anyway. G-coupled protein, thank you. G-coupled protein. When I'm up here, my brain's starting to falter here. G-coupled proteins, there's a lot of discussion, or there was a lot of discussion, it's now not, it's pretty much died down in genetic literature, whether the pain receptor, which is a G-coupled protein, whether all G-coupled proteins were brought in by pseudogenes, or whether they were present in the body and then severely edited. At any rate, it is produced by a pseudogene. It's in that category. What does Revelation 21:4 say? And there will be no more pain there. If, and I can't prove this, this is a hypothesis. When Eve was told what the curse was, there's an abundance of evolutionary biologists that think pain was brought in by pseudogenes. Therefore, and this is what they do for a living, they have no emotional thumb on the scale, that there's a suggestion that that receptor wouldn't be there. Now, I've read the book 4 years ago about advantages of pain, and I agree. And if you have leprosy, you're going to see what happens when you don't have those receptors. But you have to understand something. We don't know what that code of light does. And we don't know what it does, but it's put out as a very big thing to work to get. It is one of the big rewards. So perhaps it does something so that we would not need to worry about injuring our bodies like a leper does, because they don't have the sensation of pain to warn them to stop what they're doing. There's other mechanisms that God could use. And what does he say in 1 Corinthians 2, I think it's 8 or 9, eye hath not seen or nor ear heard what God has prepared for those who love his appearing. In other words, we can't even fathom all the systems that are going to change because we don't know all the systems that have been infected. So this is a maybe. Don't go and quote and say that, you know, transposable elements are the cause of the A and C pain receptors. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I'm suspicious. Okay, now let's go to Adam. Well, what about plants? Polyploidy, that means they have more than, we have, to be euploid, that means you have 46 chromosomes if you're a human. In plants, what happens, the mobile genetic elements have come in, and through different mechanisms, they have caused whole genome multiplications. There's one series of plants that have 44 copies of their genome. Now, they're the extreme. Most are 4 to 6. What happens when this occurs is, well, I'll let you read for yourself. We have shown that polyploid might be an important factor in species invasion and success, and suggest that ploidy must be considered in any gene model that seeks to explain why some species are more successful than others as invaders. I kind of think that sounds like weeds. What do you think? Polyploidy only can come in that we know of, that we've seen anywhere, with mobile genetic elements that have been, that affected the plants. This is just a group of weeds here. And notice that the cosmopolitan has 3 times to 22 times, depending upon which genome you look at, the number of an intact genome. And you can look at the numbers here, 10, 5, 2, 6. All the weeds have more than one. Now, the big thing that I cannot present to you tonight is thorns. And the reason we can't present that to you is because no one's done the experiment. They've not done it. It's a simple knockout experiment, but no one's done it. Now, they've taken roses, and they have, through different genetic manipulation, through breeding, have eliminated the thorns. But whenever you stress that species, the thorns reappear. Which, by the way, is an example of how mobile genetic elements work. They're the jumping genes that, remember, Barbara McClintock saw way back then, and under stress, they start producing proteins which change the plant. And when you get a thorn, instead of going clockwise and opening up as a leaf, it turns counterclockwise and it becomes a thorn. See how that works? And we know there's a mobile genetic element sitting right next to it. But no one's done an experiment where they knock that out. And all they've done is they've, through cross-pollination of different roses, have bred it out. But it comes back in as soon as you stress that plant by withholding water. And that's characteristic of mobile genetic elements. But I can't tell you that it causes it yet. I think we'll find it. But no one's done it, so it's a question mark. Genomes of replicatively senescent cells undergo global epigenetic changes leading to gene silencing and activation of transposable elements. What this paper said is, and I'll put it in simple English, I'm tired and you're tired. What happens as we get older is that the inmates take over the asylum. We're spending 30% of our energy to try to keep them under control, but if you look at the numbers game, they're destined to win, because they can copy and paste. It's not cut and paste, it's copy and paste, and they can make umpteen numbers of themselves, and they lurk around different parts of your genome. And just out of interest, 2 papers that I was censored and was not allowed to put in because for fear that I would get lost in describing things, and that the censor is right, I'm just going to tell you that they have found in neurons that when you think, and they're looking at mice, they've not done this on humans, but when the mouse, when a neural circuit is triggered, each time it's triggered, it changes the genome of at least the triggering neuron, where it starts. And that what happens if you have a neuron whose genetic area that's triggered, When a thought is generated, if it breaks, if it has a lot of mobile genetic elements, it's likely to break with that experience. And once it's broken, more mobile genetic elements can jump in, and that's called a hot spot. Now, mice don't commit sin. I'm going to do some heavy extrapolating. This is why I was censored, and the person who's censoring me is right. I am really going out on a limb here. But we're going to be following this to see more action that would happen, because what does Christ say? Christ says, it's by your thoughts Matthew 15. That's where the problem comes. And some of it ends up in behavior. James 1 says it starts out with the lust of the heart, and then it moves on to action, and then you sin. Well, this is an interesting possibility. More on that as things develop. But this is a real breakthrough I wasn't expecting. And we'll have to see where this goes. Don't go out and say that I'm preaching this. I'm saying I'm interested in it, and I'm looking for more papers, okay? I don't know. What happens to the cell is they start outgunning the cell's defenses. And so the cell starts taking, closing down with methylation. And deacetylation. It starts closing down these histones around as much as it can because it's losing the war. And as it's doing this, what happens is it ends up having to put these histone coats around now areas that are critical for it, protein coating areas that are critical. But now it's in a desperation death struggle, and it's going on this. And then what happens is you get a senescent cell. That means a cell that stops doing anything. It just sits there. And we know that all cancer cells come from senescent cells. But it does that, or it dies. The cell, the body picks up what's happening, and it undergoes apoptosis, which is an internal enfolding of the cell, or it's marked for the immune system to come and destroy. The more cells you lose, the less fit your body is. And you don't know which organ you're the most susceptible to. But eventually, one of your organs is going to quit working, because if you go long enough, you don't die of disease, you're not hit by a car, you don't take poison or something. You don't have another reason. If we put you in a bubble, eventually this is going to happen. There's no way out. You can't outstrip them. They start with an advantage you don't have, and they're going to win. And that's what this says. You know, the amount of this repression are also variable among individuals with an identical genome sequence generating epigenetically different states of loci or epialleles. This is getting to a lot of heavy. I just gave you the real Reader's Digest, real simplified, oversimplified, granted version. Why should ye be stricken anymore? Ye will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faint, from the sole of the foot even to the head. There is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and petrifying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, nor mollified with ointment. Isaiah 1, he's describing leprosy, and the Mycobacterium leprae is a perfect example of what happens with mobile genetic elements come in and take over an organism and knock out about 80% of the original genes, and now it's coded to do only one thing, live in your neurons. And it takes the stem cells, and it takes regular neurons and takes them back to stem cell, which is, you know, scientists would really like to know how they do that, engineers them back. But it's phenomenal. It's very interesting. And why does the Jewish, in the Old Testament, it talks about leprosy as an analogous to what? Sin. And leprosy is a total, mobile, genetic, element-driven disease from stem to stern. They all have gone aside. They all together became filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Guess what? We've all got it. Our first parents took it in, and it's been growing ever since. And what Crabtree made in his argument in that article, and did I tell you he's an emeritus professor at Stanford? And he came under a lot of heat for that article, by the way. He says that each generation is less fit than the one before it. Of course, we all knew that. When I was growing up, my parents would say, look what this group, you know, what are these renegades, and what, well, you know where I'm going. That was his argument. And the reason he could do it with an evolutionary point of view is that we have taken away environmental selection by allowing the misfits to live, and we feed them and everything else, and therefore they are able to crowd out in our genetic pool all of these bad genes, and that's why it's happening. He doesn't advocate euthanasia or anything like that or genetic cleansing, but he's saying that's why we're going downhill, and in evolution we were going uphill and now we're going downhill. In meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves of God, preaventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth, and that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil. And I wanted this underlined, it didn't come through. Who are taken captive by him at his will. This stuff is programmed both in our subconscious and in our conscious. And the devil is smart. He doesn't make us all like the demoniac at Gennesaret, or there would be no, we wouldn't be around. But what he does do is when he wants, he knows where his circuitry is, and he knows genetically where he's got your polyploid neurons, and he knows where to go. Ellen White says he looks at us to get our intrinsic weaknesses, and he plays on them. Our tendencies, she says, our intrinsic tendencies to do wrong, and he's able to play on them at the right time. And it's better to have you look really sane and know what you're doing, and then at the most opportune time, trigger something where you dump on religion, and now you're far more effective than if you're just going around drooling and acting that way. Those of you who saw the addiction lecture, you're going to see this again, because I'm going to show you something where we've done a modern day experiment that very clumsily, and having to do a lot of special work like putting lasers into bathing a brain of a mouse to get this done. But the way we set it up is we used mobile genetic elements to get the mouse, and they're going to tell you how to get the mouse brain susceptible to this. And then we use an outside trigger, and you're going to see what happens. Brent, I hope that works. Will it? No. So we're going to have to trigger it here. And I have two more slides, and we're done. We're almost home. Only an hour and 20 minutes late.
Playing psychological mind games. But all these methods influence the brain from the outside in. A true mind hack, one that opens us up for reprogramming of any kind, may require something more audacious. Reaching inside our living brain and flicking a switch. MIT engineer, physicist, and neuroscientist Ed Boynton has spent his career figuring out how complex machines work. He's now working on the most complex machine of all, the human brain.
A cubic millimeter of brain tissue has 100,000 cells, and there are a billion connections between them. These cells compute using electricity, and if all these little electrical computers could be recorded, perturbed, controlled, and analyzed, then maybe we could understand how the brain computed in the same way that computers are engineered to do all the things that they do in our phones and on the internet and so on. So if you have a complex system, whether it's a computer or a city or the economy or a brain, one of the ways that you can figure out what's going on is to actually put little inputs into the system and see what happens.
It's easy to test the components on a computer circuit board, but brain cells are a little trickier. So Ed set out to find a natural switch that can turn individual neurons on or off. And he found one, swimming around in a puddle of pond water.
This kind of algae actually is this light sensor. It sits in a little eye spot in the back of the algae. And basically, these are little light-activated proteins known as opsins that sit in the membranes of cells and serve as photosynthetic or photosensory protein. And this is a molecule that converts light into a very specific change in electrical potential, the exact same kind that occurs in neurons when they're active.
Ed and his colleagues extracted from the algae the genetic code that produces these light-sensitive opsins. They then inserted this gene into a virus that could splice itself into the DNA of living brain cells.
The neurons in the brain will manufacture the protein because now the genome has been incorporated into the nucleus of their cells and then express those proteins all over the membranes or boundaries of their cells.
Ed's virus instructs any infected neurons to build a light-sensitive on-off switch. With these switches, any brain circuit from our senses to our emotional state and memories could be controlled with this.
So this is a laser that we developed here, which will then split that laser light out into an array of optical fibers so that we can enter information into the brain into many different points that are distributed in a three-dimensional pattern. The brain doesn't feel pain, so we can implant little probes into the brain, deliver light out the end of these probes, and then we'll turn on or off parts of the brain just by pulsing this laser, turning the laser on and off very rapidly.
Ed and his colleagues first put their technology to trial with animal subjects. Ed wired his light-sensitive switches into a mouse's pleasure-reward brain circuits.
We put in an optical fiber into the brain such that it could deliver light to those cells. Then we programmed a computer such that whenever a mouse poked its nose into a little sensor, it would get a pulse of light.
Each pulse of blue light activates the same pleasure reward circuits that turn on when the rodent eats a piece of food or finds a mate. The mouse keeps poking its head into the hole, convinced that this simple action is the source of the reward.
And so what we found was that mice would actually work for light. They would poke their nose in the little sensor, get a pulse of light, say, hey, you know, that was interesting, and then do it over and over again, basically doing tasks in order to get a pulse of light. And so what this tells us is that very brief activation of this set of cells with a pulse of light is enough to reinforce whatever the animal was doing just before.
Ed has hacked the mind of a mouse and changed its behavior. And he believes it won't be long before we are ready to use the technique on the human brain.
Arguably, humans have been, you know, hacking the brain for a very long time. You know, beer, coffee. Those are examples of neurotechnologies that their main role is to change what the brain does. Drugs, pharmaceuticals have been very, very impactful in treating brain disorders. But if you think of the brain as a circuit, then a drug that goes throughout the entire brain is going to affect circuits that you want to leave intact as well as circuits that you want to fix. And so that's where our technologies come into play. We really can make a subset of those cells activatable or silenceable with our tools.
Ed's technology could be a cure for the nearly 1 billion people who suffer from mental illness by turning off only unhealthy cells. It would be a revolution in psychiatric medicine. And one day, it could give us all complete control of the workings of our brains. The rewards for hacking into our brains could be momentous. Mental diseases could be eliminated. We could unlock the highest levels of talent. And we could truly understand what another person feels. But there is a dark side to this technology. We could be creating a future where no one is sure of who they are. No secrets could ever be safe. And where we might all lose our minds to brain hackers.
I would argue that's happened. And I would argue what he talked about to change, that's really wishful thinking. We are so far from being able to do that. If you saw the crude, which I think was ingenious way, but a crude compared to what I suggest was done originally was far more elegant scheme. I'm telling you what he was describing at first is the way I would describe salvation, only we'd add some more things into it. And that's a different talk. So I also want to point out one other thing that I forgot to in my rush for the finish line. Remember when God came down and confronted the snake, Adam and Eve, and he told them about what was going to happen? I'm going to argue was already in place or was becoming in place. I think it took a period of time for all of these things to set up and take over. But I would suggest to you that God was saying, when he said to the serpent, I'm going to put enmity between your seed and her seed, and what he was saying when these binders, let's not call them curse, these binders are, if you are going to survive, the only way I can come in and interfere in this experiment, the following things are going to be expressed. The way you have children is going to be completely different. I mean, I have one paper that says that original life was marsupials, and then this viruses came in and made us viviparity. And they give some pretty good arguments, but it's guesswork. It's putting stuff. But if you look at the gene history as you can in genomes, at the deleted transposons who have been highly mutated, you can make some pretty good arguments for all this. I'm saying that God stepped in and said, look, the only way you as a human race can survive is that you, Adam, the earth is going to be cursed, and there's a bunch of evidence of what can happen to the microbes in the soil. And let me just tell you one thing. I didn't put the paper up, but we have a paper that shows that they went to the Amazon jungle, to an area which had never, to our knowledge, been, at least from Western people, anyone had ever come, and they didn't think any humans were in the area. Now, that could have been wrong. We don't know that for a fact, but they stated that in the paper. And they took microbes from the soil, and they had plasmids, which are mobile genetic elements that make the bacteria able to handle certain environments. They had plasmids which denatured penicillin. So that's how it can go through the entire microbiome that goes all the way around the world. So you see, all you need to do is get an introduction in one area, and no matter how you do it, and it will spread. And I took out a gene that said any type of a situation where you have sexual reproduction, mobile genetic elements will spread to all parts of it. I wanted to put in genes that shows you that it's in all living things. There's nothing that hasn't been affected by it. And for God to say this is the direct consequence of what you just did, and we look at everything he said with the exception of thorns, I can show you genetically at least that there's a lot of strong evidence that it comes from mobile genetic elements. That wouldn't you think that maybe mobile genetic elements had something to do in this scenario? I do. Now, last couple of slides. Those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities, who did not open the house of his prisoners? I will tell you, addiction is absolutely a mobile genetic element-driven pseudogene. Look it up. FOSB is the name of it. And look up JUNC, which is part of the cassette that makes up this. In mice, if you knock out the FOSB gene after the babies have developed, if you do it early on, it's one of the early genes that develop, that dictate development of both human zygotes and mice zygotes. The mice can't addict them. And if you get them addicted and you knock out this gene, the addiction goes away. So, I mean, it's an elegant bunch of studies. This is why we get addicted. It's a pseudogene that comes in. You're a prisoner. We're a prisoner to death. We've got all these mobile genetic elements that are going to kill us. It's just a matter of time. What did Christ do to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house? Another parable put he forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened to a man which sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said to him, sir, did not you sow good seed in your field? From where then has it tares? And he said to them, An enemy has done this. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut to the down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? How did he weaken the nations? He's being accused of it here. For thou hast said in thy heart, I will ascend unto heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. And I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. And I will be like the Most High. What does the Most High do? What did Christ do? He's the code writer. That's what we were told in John 1. Nothing was made that was not made by him. So what would the devil do that would really be most like the Most High that only the Most High did till this started? Right? How do you create in this system? We live in an information world. Scientists now, very convincing arguments that the basic component that all the universe is made of is information. Matter and energy simply carry it. So information rules the day. If you're going to be like the Most High, I'm going to suggest to you, you're going to write code. We're done. Any questions? Yeah?
Have you heard of Horace Mueller?
Horace Mueller?